morning, friends, and welcome to Sleepy Tom Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems, the ones you can't solve right now and will be easier to solve well rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go and drifting into sleep. Before we get on with the show, I'd like to ask for a couple of minutes of your time. The show is brought to you by direct financial support from listeners like you, mostly on Patreon, but a good number of people who throw a few dollars my way every month via Buy Me a Coffee or the PayPal tip jar on the website. There have been some lean times in the last couple of years, and I wouldn't have been able to keep the show going without that support. And I'm grateful to those listeners who have had the means to help fund it, to keep it going, and to help me to reach new audiences. If you gave any support to Sleepy Tom Tales at any point since it first started, I'm very, very grateful for your generosity and thankful that you could help me to keep this going. I've been at this for more than 2 years now, and there are, at this release, 125 episodes as well as 105 bonus minisodes up on Patreon. So if you're making use of Sleepy Tom Tales regularly to help you to deal with sleeplessness, and you have the urge to support the show, and most importantly, if you have the means, please check out patreon.com/sleepytimetales or go to the link in the show notes or from the website to get access to those bonus episodes, as well as simply to keep the show going out to those who need it. And of course, if you're more inclined to make a once-off contribution, then check out buymeacoffee.com/sleepytimetales. That's also linked in the show notes. And there you can help out the show without needing to make any kind of longer commitment. But another huge way to help the show is simply to spread the word. If there is someone in your life you think will benefit from listening to Sleepy Tom Tales, just let them know. If you recommend the show on social media, please make sure to tag me in so that I can see and I can thank you. That's at Sleepy Tom Tales on Instagram or Twitter. Shout out, of course, to the music, which is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiko. Their music is available on their website at loyaltyfreakmusic.com. I've linked the website in the show notes, as they've got some very cool stuff that they release under different names that I recommend checking out. Thank you for taking the time. Let's get back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Tom Tales? What is it for? This strange idea? This podcast that you're supposed to fall asleep to? But lack of sleep is a health crisis in the 21st century, and this is a podcast that is intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night, with your mind spinning and emotions in turmoil with anxieties of 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not quite able to doze back off at 3 a.m? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator, here to help you into a restful night. Sleepy Tom Tales is intended to be used as a distraction to what keeps you awake at night, or sometimes background noise or even company. That's why I make these episodes quite long, so that I'm here for you without any pressure of the end coming. Now, as far as I know, there's a couple of different ways to engage with the show. For me, I need something to focus on, a story or an event that lets me keep my mind on a specific point, to stop it from spinning out into stresses and anxieties, to focus just enough not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep when it comes for me. The second way is maybe you need some background noise. Some people need some kind of white noise, whether or not white noise itself, or the sound of the ocean, or wind in the trees, or the sound of rain. Or maybe just some boring dude with a bit of a deep voice droning on in the background. But however you're engaging with the show, it's important that you don't try force the sleep. Just keep a light mental grip on the thread of the story and allow sleep to come for you. Now, obviously, I'm hoping that you're asleep before I get to the end of the episode, but it is important that you don't feel pressurized. Because, especially if this is your first night, this probably won't work for you. It'll probably take a solid 2 or probably 3 nights to get used to the strangeness of the idea of listening to someone who's going to be speaking to you while you're sleeping, to get used to the sound of my voice or maybe my accent. It's also possible that for some people, one episode is just not going to be long enough, or maybe you got to engage with it slightly differently. Because some people wake up in the middle of the night and struggle to get back to sleep again, and my solution for that, because it's something that happens to me, is what I do is I download the shows that I listen to, similar sort of things to Sleepy Time Tales, but I can't listen to Sleepy Time Tales because that would be like trying to tickle yourself. And I download a whole bunch of episodes and I queue up a few in a playlist, and then as I'm going to bed, I turn it on and let the playlist go. And then when I wake up at 3 a.m. and I often find myself staring at the ceiling, it's still going. And I just, if my earbuds are falling out, I pop them back in and whoop, back, straight back to sleep again. I even do the same thing sort of if I wake up before my alarm. If it's about 30 minutes or 60 minutes before I'm due to get out of bed, I do the same and I get back to sleep again. And you may wonder, if it's 60 minutes or 30 minutes of extra sleep, what's the point of that? But that can absolutely be the best part of my night. Because there's something about allowing yourself to relax completely right before the alarm that is satisfying on a whole new level. But as you're listening, whether it's late at night or early in the morning or later in the morning, just relax into this. If this is new to you, it probably seems a little bit strange. So just give it a chance. Because I'm here to work with you, to create a safe space, a cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. The Orchid by Robert Grant. Chapter 3. Precise consideration by Lydia of her feelings for her betrothed, and presently her husband, as they were married in the following January, were rendered superfluous for the time being by the worship which he lavished upon her. There were so many other things to think of. First, her engagement ring, which called forth ejaculations of envious admiration from her contemporaries. Then her trousseau, the costumes of her bridesmaids, the details of the ceremony and the wedding breakfast, and the important question of whether the honeymoon was to be spent in Europe. There was never any doubt as to this in Lydia's mind. After deliberation, she had decided on a winter passage by the Mediterranean route to Nice and Cannes, followed by summer in the Tyrol and Switzerland, with a fortnight in Paris to repair the ravages in her wardrobe made by changing fashion. It must not be understood that Maxwell demurred to this attractive program. He merely intimated that if he remained at home and demonstrated what he called a serious side, he would probably receive a nomination for the legislature in the autumn. That the party managers had predicted as much, and that the favorable introduction into politics thus obtained might lead to Congress or a foreign mission, as he had the means to live up to either position worthily. Lydia listened alertly. I should like you to go as ambassador to Paris or London some day, of course, but to serve in the legislature now would scarcely conduce to that, Herbert. I've set my heart on going abroad. I've never been but once, you know. And it's just the time to go when we are building our 2 houses. Where should we live if we stayed at home? The sensible plan is to store our presents, buy some tapestries and old furniture on the other side, and come back in time to get the autumn hunting at Westfield and inaugurate our 2 establishments. This settled the matter. The only real uncertainty had been whether she did not prefer a trip around the world instead. But that would take too long. She was eager to figure as the mistress of the most stately modern mansion and the most consummate country house which money and architectural genius could erect. These two houses were perhaps the most engrossing of all among the many concerns which led her to postpone precise analysis of her feelings to a period of greater leisure. That is the exact quality of her love, whether it were 18 carat or not, to adopt a simile suggested to her by her wedding ring. That she loved Herbert sufficiently well to marry him was the essential point, and it seemed futile to play hide and seek with her own consciousness over the abstract proposition whether she could have loved someone else better, especially as there were so many immediately pressing matters to consider that both her physician and Herbert had warned her she was liable, if not prudent, to fall a victim to that lurking ailment, nervous prostration. It was certainly no slight responsibility to select the lot in town which seemed to combine the most advantages as the site for a residence. The matter of the country house was much simpler. For who could doubt that the ideal location was an expanse of undulating country, higher than the rest of the neighbourhood, known as Norrie's Farm? These 50 acres, with woods appurtenant, were reputed to be out of the market unless to a single purchaser. Many a pioneer had picked out Norrie's Knoll as his choice, only to be thwarted by the owner with the assertion that he must buy the whole farm, or could have none. Later would-be purchasers had recoiled before the price, which had kept not merely abreast, but had galloped ahead of current valuations, until it had become a byword in the colony that Farmer Norrie would bite his own nose off if he were not careful. But the shrewd rustic was more than vindicated by the upshot. Lydia, from the moment when she first thought seriously of Herbert Maxwell as her husband, had cast sheep's eyes at the stately property, and within a short period after the engagement was announced the title deeds passed. Rumour declared that the Cary Granter had divined the opportunity of his life was at hand, and had held out successfully for still higher figures. But as everybody cheerfully remarked, $10,000 more or less was but a flea bite to Herbert Maxwell. Then came the selection of the architects and diverse inspections of plans for the two establishments, which, to the joy of the bridegroom, were interrupted by the wedding ceremony. They sailed, and their honeymoon was of somewhat of a social parade. Special quarters, the most expensive and exclusive to be had, were engaged for them in advance on steamships and railroad trains, in hotels and wherever they appeared. Maxwell's manifest tender purpose was to gratify his bride's slightest whim. In regard to the choice of the objects on which his ready money was to be lavished, he avoided taking the initiative except when an occasional mania seized him to buy her costly gems on the sly. Otherwise he danced attendance on her taste, which was discriminating and perspicuous. Lydia yearned for distinction, not extravagance. For superlative effects, not garishness. Her eye was on the lookout in regard to all the affairs of life, from food to the manifestations of art, for the note which accurately expressed elegant and fastidious comfort, and gave the rebuff to everyday results or the antics of vulgarity. Consequently, the wedding trip after the first surprises was but a change of scene. There were still too many absorptions for retrospective thought and nice balancing of soul accounts. At Nice and Cannes they had found themselves in a vortex of small gaieties. While travelling, Lydia was on the alert to pick up old tapestries, porcelain and other works of art. In Paris, shopping and the dressmakers left no time for anything but a daily lesson to put the finishing touch to her French. She had said to herself that she would draw a trial balance of her precise emotions when she was at rest on the steamer. For Lydia, by instinct, was a methodical person. But a batch of letters reciting complications in regard to the last details on the new houses was a fresh distraction. and the society of several engaging men on the ship another. Nevertheless, the thought that she was nearing home struck her fancy favourably, and on the evening before they landed, she eluded everybody else to seize her husband's arm for a promenade on deck. There was elasticity in her step as she said, "Won't it be fun to be at Westfield again, Herbert? I long for a good run with the hounds, and I'm beginning to pine for the autumn colours and smells." "Yes, indeed. And we shall be settled at our fireside at last," he answered, with a lover's animation. The remark recalled bothersome considerations to Lydia's mind. She felt sure from the last contents of the last packet of correspondence that the architect had failed to carry out her instructions in several instances. "Settled," she echoed. "If we are settled a year from now, we may consider ourselves very fortunate." Lydia's immediate plans met with interruption from an unexpected source. Before the hunting season had fairly begun, it was privately whispered in Westfield circles that a stork would presently visit the new establishment on Norrie's farm. Open inquiries from the tactless interrogators, why the Maxwells did not follow the hounds, were answered by the explanation that the young people had so many matters to attend to in connection with their two houses that they decided to postpone hunting to another year. Later it was known that they would pass the winter in the country and not furnish the townhouse until spring. When the baby was eventually born, in February, everyone knew that it was expected. But the advent of the infant in the flesh caused a flutter among Lydia's immediate feminine acquaintances. As soon as the mother was able to receive visitors, Mrs. Walter Cole came down from town to offer her warm felicitations, and incidentally to satisfy the curiosity of those who took an interest. She had arranged to lunch after the interview with the Andrew Cunninghams, who lived all the year round at Westfield, and thither at the close of the visit to her intimate friend she repaired, replete with information. It happened to be Saturday, and the master of the house had brought down Gerald Marcy by an early train for a winter's afternoon tramp across the country, so that the two women had only a few minutes of unreserved conversation. "Well, she was just as one would expect. Lydia all over," Mrs. Cole began, with the intensity of a pent-up stream which had regained its freedom. "She looked sweet, and everything in her room and in the nursery was bewitching, as though she had been preparing for the event for years and doted on it. That's just like her, of course. She bemoaned her fate at losing the hunting season, and she has decided not to nurse the baby." "As an experienced mother," continued Mrs. Cole contemplatively, "I felt bound to remind her that there are two sides to that question, and that I had nursed Toto and Jim, not only because Walter insisted on it, but to give the children the benefit of the doubt as to any possible effect on character from being suckled by a stranger." But she had thought it all out and had her arguments at her fingers' ends. She declared it a case of Anglo-Saxon prejudice, and that every Frenchwoman of position sends her babies to a foster mother. "Of course it is a bother, and frightfully confining, but my husband wouldn't hear of it, though half the mamas can't satisfy their babies anyway." Mrs. Cunningham nodded understandingly. "I dare say it's just as well. And of course she regards the rest of us as old-fashioned. But tell me about the baby." Mrs. Cole laughed. "You ought to have heard Lydia on the subject. She talks of it in the most impersonal way, as though it belonged to someone else or were a wedding present." "I never cared much for babies before I was married, but could not endure anyone who wouldn't make flattering speeches about mine. Lydia's is a dear little thing as they go, and has a fascinating wardrobe already. And I think she is rather devoted to it in her secret soul. But one of the first things she said to me, before I could get in a single compliment, was, 'She's the living image of Grandma Maxwell, Fanny. She has a mouth and nose. And the embarrassing part was that it's true. The moment Lydia called my attention to it, I saw. Her eagle maternal eye detected what the ordinary mother would have failed to perceive. But it's Grandma Maxwell to the life. Why evade the truth, remarked Lydia after one of her deliberate pauses. I shall name her for her, and I can discern in advance that she'll never be a social success. Poor little thing, murmured Mrs. Cunningham. Such an anathema so early in her life was certainly heartrending. Mrs. Cole put her head on one side like an arch bird, by way of reflective protest. It sounds dreadful, of course, but remember, she's Lydia. What she will really do will be to metamorphose her, body and soul, so that by the time she is 18, there will be not one trace of Maxwell visible to the naked eye. See if I'm not right, she said with the gusto of a brilliant inspiration, which seemed to her a logical defense of her friend. The arrival of the men interrupted the dialogue, but the general topic was presently resumed from another point of view. Not many minutes had elapsed after they sat down to luncheon before Gerald Marcy hazarded the observation that, prophecies and innuendos to the contrary notwithstanding, events in the Maxwell household appeared to have followed the course of nature. Mrs. Cole, to whom this remark was directly addressed, ignored the sly impeachment of her abilities as a seer, and having finished her piece of buttered toast, said blandly, I think Lydia is very happy. I felt sure she would be tamed, continued Marcy with a tug at his moustache. I looked to see her become a model of domestic virtues. Don't be too sure that she is tamed, Gerald, said Mrs. Cunningham. Lydia is Lydia. Perhaps the knowledge that she had been longing in vain for years for a child of her own gave the cue to the slightly brisk comment. Lydia will never be exactly like the rest of us. That's a peculiarity, virtue, what shall I call it, interposed Mrs. Cole, looking round the table with a philosophic air. The rest of us demur at conventions, but accept them at the end. She follows what she deems the truth. I don't say that she is always right or that she doesn't do queer things, she added by way of conservative qualification over bubbling encomium. And how about Maxwell? Asked Andrew Cunningham, who had seemed temporarily lost in the contemplation of his lobster salad so long as any of that lusciously prepared viand remained on his plate. Infatuated as ever, I suppose, he added, sitting back in his chair and exposing benignly his broad expanse of neckcloth and fancy check waistcoat. Yes, and he ought to be, surely. But Lydia has a rival in the daughter of the house, answered Mrs. Cole, inspired by the inquiry. He came in just as I was leaving and is almost daft on the subject of the baby. If Lydia's ecstasy is somewhat below the normal, he more than makes up for the deficiency. There never was such a proud parent. He just chortled in his joy. He discerns in her already all the graces and virtues and would like to do something at once. He doesn't know exactly what, to bring them to the attention of an unappreciative world. If it were a boy, he could put his name down on the waiting list at the clubs, but as she is only a girl, he must content himself with hanging over a crib for the present. Only a girl, echoed Marcy, born with a golden spoon in her mouth, an heiress to all the virtues and graces, and predestined, doubtless, like her mother, to rest her dainty foot upon the neck of a man. Nevertheless, as I have already prophesied, I am inclined to think that the yoke, now a double yoke, will not bear too severely on Maxwell, though it may not yield him to the bliss which we unregenerate bachelors are wont to associate with the ideal marital relation. Hear, hear, exclaimed Andrew Cunningham. You need some further liquid refreshment after that silver-tongued sophistry, Gerald. Mary, he said to the maid, pass the whiskey and soda to Mr. Marcy. Mrs. Cole put her head to one side. I have my doubts whether the ideal marital relation is such a modern social possibility. The strictly ideal, such as you bachelors mean, she added, feeling, doubtless, as the wife of a man to whom she had described herself in hot-to-hot talks with another woman. Not many, for she eschewed the subject ordinarily as sacred, as deeply attached, that this homily on wedlock needed a qualifying tag. But May Cunningham was not in the mood to become a party to even so tempered an imputation on connubial happiness. "Speak for yourself, Fanny," she said sturdily. "Ideals or no ideals, Andrew and I trot in double harness better than any single animal of my acquaintance." "Listen to the old woman, God bless her," exclaimed the master of the house, raising his tumbler and smiling at his better half with chivalrous expansiveness. Mrs. Cole was a little nettled at Mrs. Cunningham's obtuseness. Willful obtuseness, it seemed to her. As though the subtle social problem suggested by her was to be solved by reference to the homely affection of this amiable but limited couple. She sighed and murmured, "Everyone knows, my dear, that you and Andrew are as happy as the day is long. But I'm afraid you don't understand exactly what I mean." Mrs. Cunningham compressed her lips ominously. She felt that she understood perfectly well, and it was simply another case of Fanny Cole's nonsense. But any retort she may have been mediating was averted by the timely and genial inspiration of her husband. "One thing is certain," he said. "We all know that our Gerald is the ideal bachelor." This assertion called forth cordial acquiescence from both the ladies, and turned the current of the conversation into a smoother channel. The subject of the remark bowed decorously. In this company I am free to admit that I sometimes sigh in secret for a happy home. Yet even venerable bachelorhood has its compensations. "By the way," he added, "a colony at Westfield is likely to have an addition to its stud of bachelors. I hear that Harry Spencer is coming home." "Harry Spencer? How interesting," cried the two women in the same breath. "The fascinator," continued Mrs. Cole, with slow, sardonic articulation. "To break some other woman's heart, I suppose," said Mrs. Cunningham. "And yet it is safe to say that he will be received with open arms by your entire sex, including the present company," remarked Gerald, with a tug at his moustache. The sally was received with pensive silence, as a deduction apparently not to be gainsaid. "He is very agreeable," said Mrs. Cunningham flatly. "And extremely handsome," said Mrs. Cole. "Not the type of manly beauty which would cause my mature heart to flutter, but dangerous to the youthful imagination. He used to look like a handsome pirate, and if he had whispered honey words to me instead of to Laura, who knows? Poor Laura." That neither of them assent, there was nothing for him to do but withdraw. And yet there's no doubt he broke her heart, though there is consumption in her family. Mrs. Cole knit her brows over this attempt on her part to formulate complete justice. "He's a woman's man," said Andrew Cunningham. He had stepped to the mantelpiece to fill his pipe, and having uttered this fell speech, he lit it and smoked for some moments in silence, with his back to the cheerful wood fire before proceeding. No one had seen fit to contradict him. The gaps between his assertions and the subsequent explanations thereof were expected and rarely interrupted. "He does everything well. Rides, shoots, plays rackets, golf, cards, is infernally good-looking, as you say, has a pat speech and a flattering eye for every woman he looks at. And yet somehow he always struck me as a poseur. I wouldn't trust him in a tight place, though he prides himself with his sporting blood. It may be prejudice on my heart. Gerald likes him, I believe, because he is a keen rider and always has a good mount. He always has the best of everything going. But what does he live on anyway?" Wild oats, perhaps, suggested Marcy. But he hastened to atone for this levity by adding, he had a little money from his mother while it lasted, and just after he and Miss Wolford drifted apart, I'm told he followed a tip from Gar Perry on copper stocks, and cleaned up enough to enable him to travel the world. Poor Laura, interjected Mrs. Cole. What a pity he didn't get a tip earlier. It wasn't enough to marry on, said Marcy, and it's probably mostly gone by this time. That's the sort of thing I complain of, exclaimed Cunningham. I'm no martinet in morals, heaven knows, but always feel a little on my guard with fellows who live by their wits and spend like princes. Confound it, you know, it isn't quite respectable, even in a free country. Andrew spoke with a wag of his head, as though he expected to be adjudged an old fogey for this conservative utterance. He's an attractive fellow on the surface, anyway, answered Marcy after a pause, and will be an addition from the hunting standpoint. And give the devil his due, Andrew, if he was looking for money only, there were several heiresses he might have married. That would have made him irreproachable at once. Mrs. Cole drew a long breath. Perfectly true, Mr. Marcy. I never thought of it before. Harry Spencer doesn't look at a woman twice unless he admires her, no matter how rich she is. He could have married several, of course, if he had tried. Dozens. That's the humiliating part of it, asserted Mrs. Cunningham. When he's ready to settle down, that's what he'll do. Pick out some woman with barrels of money, said Andrew. Having once got a proposition in his head, he was wont to stick to it tenaciously, like a puppy to a root. You misjudge him, you misjudge him, cried Mrs. Cole eagerly. He won't do anything of the kind. He'll never marry any woman unless she has money, or he has, that I'm ready to admit. But on the other hand, he'll never ask anyone to marry him unless he loves her for herself alone, and... She continued with a gasp, born of the thrill which the definiteness of her insight caused her. There are very few women in the world whom he is liable to fall in love with. That's what makes him so interesting. He's polite to us all, but the majority of women bore him at heart. Marcy laughed. A masterly diagnosis, he said. And now that he has seen the world and is returning heart-free, so far as we know, there will naturally be curiosity as to how he will bear the ordeal of a fresh contact with native loveliness. Exactly, said the two women together, and with an engaging frankness which quite overshadowed the grunt by which the master of the house indicated his suspicious dissent from this exposition of character. Chapter 4 Harry Spencer had been travelling nearly 3 years. Naturally, he found some changes and some new faces at Westfield. Concerning the former, he was becomingly appreciative. He promptly arranged himself on the side of progress, admired the new clubhouse and the new establishments in the neighbourhood, and evinced a willingness to take an active part in the enlarged energies of the club. During his peregrinations in foreign lands, he had visited the St. Andrews Golf Links, and he had views regarding bunkers and other features of the game which he was prepared to advocate. When he had left home, the bicycle was all the rage, and some portion of his journeyings had been on an up-to-date machine. But he found now that the fashionable portion of the community had dropped this craze, and that to ride a wheel was beginning to be considered a bore except as a means of getting from one place to another. The fever of golf was rampant instead, and had reached the stage where its votaries were almost delirious in their devotion, notably the people most unfitted to play the game, and had taken it up in order to be in fashion. During the spring and summer following his return, the improved links at Westfield was crowded with players of every grade, whose proficiency was generally in reverse proportion to the number of clubs they carried. Soon after the season had fairly opened and the greens were in good order, the lately returned wanderer found himself one morning engaged in giving a lesson in the royal and ancient game to Miss Peggy Blake, who had a severe attack of the disease and promised to be a proficient pupil. for Dobson, the professional at the Hunt Club, had declared that she had a free swing and could follow through as well as most men. The trouble at the moment was that after taking a free swing, she either failed to hit the ball altogether or hit it off at some distressing angle. As she explained volubly to everybody, until within a week she had been making screaming brassy shots, which carried 150 yards, but had suddenly lost her game completely. Harry had kindly offered himself as a coach, a delightful proposition to the blithe young woman, especially as Dobson was engaged for the time being in superintending the primary and elephantine efforts of Miss Ella Marbury, the stout maiden sister of Wagner Marbury, the Western multimillionaire and proprietor of one of the new neighbourhood palaces, so obnoxious to Mrs. Cunningham. Miss Peggy was more than pleased to have for an hour or two the uninterrupted companionship of this good-looking and redoubtable gallant, whose attentions were to be regarded as a feather in her cap, and would doubtless be able to tell her what she was doing wrong. Hers was one of the new faces, and Harry had given his following to understand that he admired her spirited and comely personality. Miss West Wind, he had christened her genially, and the epithet had spread with the rumour that he had noticed her. Yet it was tacitly understood that he had no intention of interfering with the suit of his friend Guy Perry, who was supposed to be well in the lead of the other pursuers of the Breezy Maiden. Yet, though he sought to give the impression that his favour in this case was merely an artistic tribute, and that he still walked scatheless in the world of women, he was glad of an opportunity to stroll over the links in her society. She would entertain him. Besides, she was a fluent talker, and could count on her retailing for his edification more or less the entire history of Westfield written between the lines, which was only to be picked up gradually by one who had been prevented by absence from personal observation. It was a very simple matter to detect the trouble with his companion's stroke. "You don't keep your eye on the ball, Miss Blake. That's the whole trouble with you. Anyone can see that." Peggy looked incredulous. "If there is one special thing more than another which I try to bear constantly in mind, it is to keep my eye on the ball. Do I really take it off, Mr. Spencer? Of course you must know. There's so many other things to remember, but I did think I was completely disciplined on that point. Watch me now." Thereupon she proceeded to execute a dashing stroke, her evident standard being to carry her club through with such velocity as to bring the head around to her left shoulder, and cause her to execute a pirouette like the pictures of the golfing girls in the magazines. The ball flew off at a tangent and narrowly missed her own caddy. "How rotten," she murmured. "I had both my eyes glued to the ball, and you see what happened. And only a week ago was driving like a streak." Her expletive was merely the popular phrase of the day by which golden youth of both sexes were apt to express even trivial dissatisfaction. She was a pathetic figure in distress. Her exertions had heightened her colour so that it suggested the poppy rather than the rose, and was not unlike the hue of a trig golfing garment. She swept back a stray ringlet which had escaped from under her hat. "You see, I have lost my game utterly, Mr. Spencer." Harry laughed. "You were looking at me out of the corner of your eyes that time. Lower your lids till you exaggerate the modest maiden, and don't move your head." It was a half-deferential, half-sardonic voice, with a caressing touch, indicating temporary devotion to the subject matter in hand, which was flattering. "Swing more easily," he added, "and don't try to rival the Gibson girl until you recover confidence." Then he corrected slightly her stance and the position of her hands, all with a deft yet bantering grace of manner which soothed and attracted her. He went through the correct motions of the stroke for her enlightenment, and as he stood erect and supple, Peggy did not forbear to reflect that he was very handsome. How dark his hair and eyes were. It was a bold sort of beauty, and though he wore neither moustache nor beard, the faintly bluish tinge of his complexion betrayed that, but for the barber, he would have been what Mrs. Herbert Cole might have termed an incarnate symphony in black. He appeared harmoniously muscular. He executed the next three movements with lithe, nervous energy, focusing attention tensely for the brief occasion. The moment he lowered his club, he regained his leisurely and rather indolent demeanor. His pupil essayed to follow his instructions. At the third attempt, the ball sailed straight as an arrow to a moderate distance, which comforted the performer, but she felt too nervously excited to exult. It might only be an accident. "Try again," he said confidently. "You've almost got it." Once more the ball shot correctly from the club. Harry stooped and placed another on the tee. Peggy swung, then followed through with a little of her old elasticity. It flew like a rifle bullet, low and long, across the distant bunker. She rose on the tips of her toes as she followed its entrancing flight. "I've got back my game," she cried jubilantly. "You've saved my life, Mr. Spencer." She looked as though she would have been glad, had convention permitted, to throw her arms around her benefactor's neck. And to the true golfer, it would not seem an exaggerated reward. "I've been in the slough of despond for nearly a week, and playing worse every day. Now I'm in the seventh heaven, and it's all your doing." He acknowledged the exuberant gratitude with a graceful, mock-heroic bow. "I shall consider my terms. The charge should be considerable." Just then, by the sheerest chance, a white carnation which Peggy was wearing at her throat became detached from her dress and fell to the ground. He picked it up and, holding it before him and looking into her eyes, said with melodious assurance, "I will keep this, if I may, as my tuition fee." Peggy looked embarrassed and let fall her eyes, albeit not easily disconcerted. The carnation was one from a bunch which Guy Perry had sent her the day before, and to hand it over seemed almost an act of treason, though they were not yet actually engaged. Yet she was conscious that she thought of this new acquaintance charming. Silence gives consent where lovely woman is concerned. At any rate, when she looked up, he was in the act of placing it in his buttonhole. But his fingers had paused in their work as a consequence of his arrested glance. A feminine figure outlined on the crest of adjacent rising ground had suddenly caught his eye. She was addressing her ball for a brassy shot, and as he gazed, it was performed with a sweeping grace of which the lack of effort was the salient charm. Peggy, whose eyes had promptly followed the direction of his, vouchsafed the desired information. "Mrs. Herbert Maxwell." "Really?" There was a shade of interest in the monosyllable, as though the identity of someone whom he had been rather curious to meet had been revealed to him. "You haven't met her?"
"Not yet."
"Oh, you'd like her immensely." The words were uttered with such naive confidence that Harry Spencer turned away his gaze from the new attraction to survey the old. "How do you know?" he inquired jauntily. Peggy spluttered a little at this flank attack.
"Oh, well, you know, she's so awfully clever. She's different."
"She'd pique your curiosity anyway," she concluded, recovering her aplomb.
"Am I so difficult to please?" he asked sententiously.
He answered the question himself.
"Yes, I admit that I am."
His look of admiration, which Peggy divined was constitutional with him on such occasions, was best to be met by diversion.
I shall never be able to play golf as Lydia Maxwell does, and I've been at it twice as long. She's only played this spring, and Dobson says that she has a better idea of the game than any other woman. It's just knack with her for her balls to go farther than mine, and yet she makes scarcely an exertion. You couldn't help admire her in all sorts of ways. It has been a dreadfully quiet season for her, though, for when her baby was 6 weeks old and she sent out cards for two musical parties in the new townhouse, her husband's mother, old Mrs. Maxwell, died suddenly, and she had to go into mourning. So they went to Southern California for February and March and moved down here as soon as they returned. She took lessons in golf at Los Angeles, and she beat me 4-up the first time we played, even though I supposed I could give her half a stroke. While he listened to this monologue, Spencer followed the progress of the subject of it. She was playing with pretty Mrs. Baxter, but though her opponent was an ordinarily graceful woman, there was a deft harmony in her movements which made Mrs. Baxter appear an unfinished person by comparison. They say the real secret is that she has an autistic temperament. The speech was Peggy's by way of reading his thoughts and providing a condensed and comprehensive key. And her husband, what is he like? You know, he has come to the surface during my absence. He hasn't it at all. I mean, an artistic temperament. But he's an awfully good sort. Awfully. A true sport. And kind as can be. Peggy's vocabulary of enthusiasm, though fundamentally naive, sometimes made reprisals on the kindred jargon of Great Britain. I see. And you infer that I have an autistic temperament? A tendency towards challenging unexpectedness was one of Spencer's prime manifestations with women. Peggy looked embarrassed. She had not bargained for such an unequivocal piece of teasing. She put up her hand to her head to secure her escaping comb. I don't know you very well, of course, but I had supposed so. Yet I'm not clever and I dote on Lydia, she added archly. Harry Spencer did not have to go out of his way for an opportunity to satisfy his curiosity by personal acquaintance with Mrs. Herbert Maxwell. When he and his fair partner had finished the last hole and approached the piazza of the new clubhouse, they found her sitting there, one of a group of both sexes waiting for luncheon. Peggy, radiant and prodigal of superlatives, proclaimed to one after another that her game had come back. Wasn't it perfectly glorious? The loveliest thing which had ever happened. And Mr. Spencer had detected at once what was wrong. Just think of it. I was pressing and I took my eye off the ball, she kept reiterating, and I never knew it. Wasn't it dear of him? One of the most characteristic features of golf is that it is not an altruistic pastime. Everyone is feverishly absorbed by the state of his own game and does not care at heart for his neighbors. At the moment of Peggy's vociferous advent, the assembled company was talking in pairs, and each member of each pair was endeavoring to excite the interest of his or her partner in the dialogue by glowing or dejected narration of why his or her score was lower or higher than the speaker's average. In some cases, both were talking at once and neither listened. Oftener, perhaps, each had asserted an innings. And the strongest, almost persistent lungs held the mastery. Miss Marbury, who under the tutelage of Dobson had done the longest hole in 12, and the 18 holes in 132, five better than ever before, was bubbling over with ecstasy and soliciting congratulations. Douglas Hale, who had failed by one stroke to surpass his previous record of 82, was telling hoarsely and pathetically to everyone whom he could buttonhole how it happened. At the 14th hole, I was on green and 2 and took 7 for the hole. 7. Just think of that. 7. 5 strokes on the green. As he uttered the words with excruciating precision, he would hold up the 5 fingers of his hand and shake them at his auditor. It was an experience which would last him all day and far into the evening as he could find new listeners, especially if he could endeavor to take the edge off his disappointment by scotch and soda. Consequently, though everybody heard that Miss Peggy Blake had recovered her game and her breezy invasion caused a stir, the fact that she had done so was of interest only because of the means by which this had been brought to pass. It was Harry Spencer, not she, who became the cynosure of numerous feminine eyes. If he had put Peggy onto her game, why not them onto theirs? Peggy, mistaking the reason for the pause in the general chatter for interest in her improvement, proceeded to rehearse gleefully the details of her triumph for the benefit of the company. But Douglas Hale, in no mood to be sidetracked by any such interruption, stepped forward and, hooking his arm in Harry Spencer's, led him apart with a mysterious, "A word to you, old man." And I think I'm going to leave it there. This really is a rather charming little story, and I'm quite enjoying it. So I think it may be worth you to look up if you're liking it yourself. As usual, you can find the book on Project Gutenberg at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Time Tales, the podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes will be released every Sunday night to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week. But make sure to subscribe in whatever service you use so that you get your new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiku. Check out more of their work on their website, which you'll find linked in the show notes. Good night, and sweet dreams.